We've got the last of the evening talks before Easter. So I'm very pleased to welcome Chris Workman, who I think is probably known to just about all of us here. But we're very pleased to have his expertise and his help in Forum Four in general, and tonight in particular for talking about the ecology of the area. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me, Sue. What I want to be able to do today is hopefully that, sorry, if that's getting work, beside the noises, is just have a look at the whole of the area and ask some of the questions, what do we want out of the area? And we can see, I'm sure you can recognise the picture. I won't have a prize for guessing where each photograph is taken from. It was a busy day last Friday, was it? Or last Thursday, I saw you after you were mending all the fences, Mick. Anyway, what we want to be able to have a look at is, therefore, really the organisms, including, to emphasise, the invertebrates, because although everybody talks about the birds, they're fine, they're not. They've got to have an understory, like a whole group of organisms there that we don't often see as a regular interval. So I want to show a series of pictures today to be just to open your eyes maybe to the variety of life that should be there. I'm going to go back at the moment and think about the area, how it got to where it is at the moment. We've got to think about how the habitats actually arrived there. We've got whatever you see, whatever you've created, but we want to be able to spend a couple of minutes thinking about how they have got there and how they might change. A second question that I can't answer tonight, what do you want out of it? Because it's your nature, isn't it? And everybody's going to have a different answer. Is it, I suddenly want it to have the osprey staying here? Or something that they're flying over, apparently, today. Is it something like butterfly conservation? I want a particular species of butterfly there. In which case, you've got to manage it for that situation. There's going to be conflict. Some people might look at just the archaeology and want to preserve it, fine. But there's going to be conflict within it, and that's where hopefully you all get together and can sort out the proper management for something that becomes for the collective good. So the question comes up, what have we got to look for to be able to manage the area? And in doing so, we need to look at, therefore, the organisms that are there. What have we got? Obviously grassland at the moment, most of it is there in one form or another. The woodlands, looking, Pony Woods just at the top there, yes. Hedgerows, Lucy Brook, that's going across the bottom of the picture there. Stream ponds, we've dug out lots and lots of scrapes. So at the moment there's a variety of habitats that we want to be able to look at. Do we need more? Do we manage for some? Will managing for more woodland affect the grassland? You've got to be able to balance up these arguments as what we've actually got in there. But coming back to the original question, how did that group of habitats, particularly the grassland and the hedgerows, arrive there? But I want to think back a long time, not just as Mike did to the medieval era. Let's try 10,000 years. Glaciation. We must have been covered with a glacier. There was not a lot here. High ice. Okay. It's got cleared. What's happened since then is what we refer to as succession. From the bare ground that was, as the glacier disappeared, the various plants would have colonised and come in. And the eventual, what we call the climax community of the situation here, should have been woodland. Whether it's car, always been very wet on the woodland, or whether, as Pony Wood is now, remnants of bits of oak and other things coming in. But that is the what we call the climax community that should be there. Why isn't it there now? Right. Presumably, sometime in the past, it got cut. Fire, grazing, and we're looking back, presumably, don't know how much evidence there is, any Iron Age, Bronze Age cultures, but certainly by Roman times, the whole area was probably cleared. Right. Odd patches of forest, it would be a lot of it undrained, as the local farms called the Car House Meadow. The car is a very wet land. And in the field names and place names, you get clues as to what conditions are actually like there. How's it maintained now? Well, not so much by cutting, by grazing. And that has stopped the emergence of the trees. That's a principal way, of course, in medieval times it was ploughed. Okay. They remove what would normally be developing the actual woodland. And what we they have encouraged, of course, is grassland, which is highly productive. It's what we want as crops. Mike was talking the other week about growing the oats as records from the priory to be able to make their wine, mead, whatever they were doing, their purified water. Alcohol is very good at purifying everything. So it ends up there as growing the crops, and now, of course, since, as far as Mike's concerned, as far as we know, it's just been grazed to maintain the grassland situation since 400 years, something of that order. Okay. There's the culprits. Well, recent variety of culprits coming round, and so we're ending up. Yes, it's a dominant form because we put them there. And what they're wanting to eat is something that is highly nutritious. Well, of course, the white park are able to digest the species of plant that the Frisian perhaps would not want to eat. They eat much more slowly. Their digestive system is slightly different. So that it ends up they're slow growing, slow maturing, but they can look after the habitat in a different way. They don't need the productive grassland that a normal pastoral system would. And that's why these original breeds are encouraged, and they can take out selectively a lot of the species, and they will even eat, I think, some of the sedge that are there. It's amazing what they will actually stomach. But they prefer the nice juicy bits like lots of other things. So it's not just the white park there, but there's a few other things. Yes, we've still got the white park in the corner there. But we've got to think about, okay, the flora, buttercups and various goosegrass grasses along the, if I take that photograph, the path towards Little Wood from the Lucy Brook, somewhere along the banking, they're just coming out into flower. It's quite attractive. As the season progresses, becoming reasonably attractive. We've got, of course, our snipe that are there, and every month, I think we have the count, as the flush counts. They just seem to be doing quite well. We've got, just as an illustration, lots of insects. Okay, we've got cranefly there. We don't see the young of the cranefly at all. Why? They're just underground. And it's difficult, therefore, to dig them out. If you've got them in your garden, you know about it, and you don't want to use them. That's a good wolf spider. They're pretty when they're blown up. It's quite nice. It's a wolf spider. They're running around now, when I looked last week, certainly in a bit of sunshine. And what people don't realise is a whole set of microorganisms. That's, okay, it's clover roots. They're what we call root nodules. And they have what we call nitrogen-fixing bacteria in those nodules. We'll talk more about microbes later, but in fact, microbes, although this isn't about them, run the whole system. They are fundamentally important to the ecosystem. Right. We get back there. Okay. I want now to look at how it works. A different way of thinking about it. Not just a list of species, but think about how we can present those species. It's not just a pretty, we'll go through the phyla. Right, okay, what have we got? Any system needs energy. We've got the sun. Sorry, it's not yellow. They're going to provide the energy coming into the system, and what uses sunlight? The plants. And what we refer to as producers, they're the only organisms which will actually make biomass. I'm sure you've heard all about your green energy values and what we should do. It's the plants that actually produce the matter that everything else depends upon, including the microbes. So from our plants, things eat the plants, okay? They're primary consumers or herbivores, things like rabbits, fine. The cattle, white park would fit in there, as long as lots of others. We then have what they call secondary consumers, which would be your predators, and tertiary predators, third level going up. But what actually runs the system quite often is a group of things that recycle the dead material. The microbes that will actually allow the nutrients to come back to the plant without us having to spread fertilizer on the ground. So that's the principle. What we're going to have a look at is run through organisms going up the what's called food chain. The other question that we need to put out, what are we looking at the moment? We've got monocultures, effectively, at the moment. You look at the grass, officially it's not a monoculture. It's been sown, there's one or two other species in there. But we've got the same. We are presumably heading for, or wanting to have, some sort of, I call it polyculture, lots of different species which are nice, good pollen producers for all of the insects to be able to support elsewhere. You've got a greater variety of food materials for other organisms to actually eat. And a lot of our organisms, particularly the arthropods, are all specialists. And it's certainly true with some of the birds, for example. They are picking different size seeds. Okay? They become, if you can produce a field with a variety of different size seed producing plants, you're going to get a variety of animals, of those birds, into the area. And if that's the aim, to have high diversity, of course that's the way I think where management is going. I've put down the term high productivity. The original type of grass that's grown there grows quickly. It's the species which will produce a lot of biomass. They are efficient transformers of sunlight into matter. Good, because cows eat them and eat mankind benefits. It requires fertilizers to do it. And one of our problems, of course, with the flora fields is that they are still in that situation of having a high nutrient value in the soil. It means that the plants that like the nutrient can grow quickly there, and they then outcompete anything else. Because a lot of the low productivity ones, the diversity of the flowering types that we would have, want or can manage on low nutrients. Right? But, of course, they don't grow quickly. If there's something else that's growing quickly next door to it, they won't see the sunlight. So what we've got to do is be able to try and cut out some of the nutrients, and particularly try and harm some of the grasses that are there. So, of the plants, we've got to increase the diversity. And how are we doing it? Yellow rattle. It's a semi-parasitic plant. It's been sown onto the grass fields to be able to harm the current grasses that are there. It takes out some of the nutrients from the actual plant and reduces their productivity, their vigour of growth. And one of the criteria for your higher stewardship funding and all the rest of it is how much yellow rattle have you got growing there? It's a good indicator of a field that is going to decrease the productivity and increase diversity of the plants there. So we end up with lower productivity out of it. But we also need to increase the habitat type, and that's in the bottom area of Gleason's field. What's there growing there, it doesn't seem to be rotting very quickly, but it provides another habitat. If we increase the amount of dead grass there, okay, living grass would be able to go through it, there's going to be a source of food for something to be able to eat there, and space for the arthropods to be able to live. And if we can increase that amount of the actual system, then we should be able to go we would increase the diversity of different animals and plants that can actually be there. Okay. We've got that. Oh, that's all right. Okay, so what happens to all the dead grass? It's in the end turned into humus. But how? By what? Lots of the animals and the microbes that are there, which we'll have a look at. The humus is this black material that's in the soil. It is partly broken down organic material. And that ends up providing some nutrients, or releasing nutrients, for the plants, therefore, to be able to grow further. And it will end up providing a lot of, in fact, food source for a variety of different organisms, usually insect larvae in particular, to be able to grow in that area. Generally, humus is good for the soil. I'm sure most of you as gardeners also say, how do I improve my soil? Stick on some organic material. Stick on some humus on it. If it's too acid? Stick the humus on, it'll reduce the acidity. What if it's too alkaline? Stick the humus on, it'll reduce. It's a stabilising system. And it increases the space between the soil particles such that more oxygen can get in there. If my soil's too waterlogged, stick in some humus, it's all right. It's a good thing for all of our growth and a variety of different species. What about the fertilisers then, Bob? We've said probably farmers up to now, particularly for flora, have put on artificial fertilisers, NPK, they spread it by hand or by tractor, I don't know what Fraser has been doing. You might be able to tell me how often the tractors have gone along the fields or spread the artificial fertiliser. Yes, it's good for farming. Is it good for what you want? If you want lots of hay, yes. If you want lots of flowering plants and insects and pollinators, then probably not. We need to do it in a different way. So, how does it happen naturally? We use organic fertiliser. Cows usually produce it. Okay. And hence, yes, what happens to it? It's got to decay. We've got fungus flies there, come back in. They actually don't feed very much on it, but they lay their eggs in it. And what's actually breaking down the cowpat is a series of larvae. Of insect larvae that chew through it quite happily, okay, and they will then grow and hatch and will get a generation through in 4 or 5 weeks. Well, it certainly can be that of several of the flies. But we also have beetles, dung beetles. Yes. You've probably seen the Attenborough pictures where you could have these dung beetles taking up elephant dung, for example, and rolling it in this ball and then burying it, and then they lay an egg in it. Well, our dung beetles are lazy. They just end up laying the eggs in the bottom or underneath the actual cow fat, and the larvae are able to then eat from underneath the actual crust of the cow fat, so you see it underneath. But yes. Excellent insects there that we want to be able to have a look at as the dung beetles. And don't ask me to name dung beetles, there's, I don't know how many, 400,000 species of beetles in this country or something? There's rather a lot, so I haven't got a clue, is the answer. Right, what else is going to be the plant material? animals that you know. You're happy to your standard woodlouse, your earthworm, come up, eat the organic material. The feces then, it's all broken down. They've gained some of the energy out of it, the nutrients out of it, and what they produce at the end is able for, it enables the microbes there in the soil. And I haven't got lots of pictures of microbes because they're not pretty, they're just rod shaped or ground shaped. They're shaped. They can break it down much more easily. And it's that, if like microbial decomposition, which actually releases the nutrients for the plants then to be able to use and absorb through the roots. So the term trichophores, okay, for eating the waste or non-cow-eaten plant material that's just left there. But others, okay, lots of arthropods, invertebrates. We've got our millipede there. The millipede, we've got the standard sort of slugs. They'll be in the garden, they're going to eat the fresh producers as well, the grass, any other sort of plants, as well as the dead material. And this is the common banded snail, Cypinemorales, I remember that one. There's up and down all the plants, but they're there as the first level of detritivores before the waste again, just like the woodlice, the earthworm that they produce, is therefore available for microbes at recycling. Okay. That's about the only picture of microbes. No, I've got one other. Of microbes that are there. We must remember, okay, what do we see as our of those decomposers? We see the fungi. We see toadstools, mushrooms, toadstools. Most of all the toadstool is, or the mushroom, is a reproductive head. It's only a little bit of the life cycle. And what most of the fungus is what we call a mycelium of fibres. Hyphen, what the technical term for all of them are. And you probably recognise it, or you may not. Our bread mould, I just put that in there. What you see when your bread mould's got mouldy, okay, you see green bits growing all over it, and if you've left it really too long, you see that the equivalent of the mushroom head coming up that produces the spores. So in the soil that we don't see anything about, it's these fungal hyphae that do the decomposition. They are the ones that are actually rotting and removing it. And of course what they're doing also is providing a food source, okay, which we'll come on to. That's another reason that we've also got the microbes running it. There are a group of microbes which are really clever. They need lots of energy from somewhere, but what they do is to take atmospheric nitrogen and turn it into useful fertilizer, into what we call nitrates. Ammonium compounds. There are a group of plants like the beans that we know about, and clover, alfalfa, and others that produce or have a special relationship with some of these microbes, these bacteria, and they allow them to live in the root. So this sunlight energy comes through the plant makes its sugars, and it then feeds these bacteria in their roots. And what the roots are then able to do is, when the microbes are, produce the nitrates, and in areas where there aren't very many nitrates, normally they will make those plants grow. So what do we see? Fairy rings. These fairy rings you can see as really good, lush, green areas, usually as a circle, because the fungus has gone out there. It originally started as a small patch in the middle, and then the fungus gets bigger and bigger. It grows in a circle, always growing outwards. And it's able to then create the nitrogen there. So the way that the system works is not just the arthropods are there, not just the bigger organisms, but it's quite often these microbes which are running part of the show. And then you get the things feeding on microbes. Tiny little things. These are what we call calembola, springtails. We found them on some of the arthropod surveys when I bothered to look, but they're normally tiny. They're about kind of, well, a really massive one is 4 millimetres. It's bigger on the picture. These have got it's a spring tail. It's quite often folded underneath the body there, and then they just jump out of the way. And for their size, if that's 4 millimetres long, they can jump 10 centimetres. They can actually move quite a long way. It's quite impressive when they suddenly disappear. So, oh, look at that. No, I'm not. It's gone. Another sort of decomposer feeding on fungi is bark lice. Sometimes you see them home, book lice. But there's lots of little things that are, this one won't fly, it's just living normally underneath the bark in the area there. And it's feeding, on bits of fungi quite often, it's decomposing anything around it. So there's a whole group, if we encourage the humus there, don't plough it and don't do anything, keep on there, we'll get lots of these, and of course these then provide food for the predators later on. But still keeping on the flowers, okay, lots of flowers we want pollinators, as we have the bees. So you've got the bumblebees, okay, there. There are a lot of a variety of diptera, the flies, that will feed on pollen. How much pollination they do is debatable. But in terms of agricultural crops, they say they're not particularly good at all, but they are there, they feed on it, they form part of the habitat, the larvae will usually be somewhere else feeding on another part of the plant. In the same way, common butterfly, okay, the adults there, the younger bit, will feed on leaves from a variety of different organisms. It's not very fussy, as far as I know, for the common butterfly. But there are some species that are very fussy on what they feed. But lots of flowers will promote a good diversity, and seeing the butterflies during the day, or moths evenings as well, or day-flying moths, is quite useful. We've also got things called plant suckers, poor plants. They suffer everywhere. You actually know that spittle bug. What you see as the spittle there is a protective cover for the larva of that spittle bug, which is the adult there. It lays the egg, and then its young nymph plugs itself into the... it's actually the water system of the plant, going up the stem, and it then froths it around itself to produce a protective coat. And it will be feeding on producing an awful lot of the water, trying to get the nutrients that the plant sucked out of the soil. And it will grow. But those are spittle bugs. We've then got our leaf hopper. And these, you can just see on the surface of the leaf, they basically pierce each individual cell of the leaf and sucked out the chlorophyll and the contents of the actual leaf. So we can see, they're not the same as mice, but blotches on the surface of leaves, and that's where they've been. And of course, greenfly, aphids. Yeah, I won't say much about it, but I'm sure you've met them all. Of course, too many of them. They're all young ladies, those. They're all produced with it, that size, if like adult, but without having any fertilisation. They are produced by what we call parthenogenesis. And that's why there are so many of them. They don't bother to find them out. They just sit there and produce an egg, and another egg, and another egg. And the egg develops into all these little aphids, and they suck my poor beans too much. But that's the, and sometimes the winged adults are produced for dispersal and for the males to find the females. Then, of course, we've got the normal plant eaters you're associated with. You recognise the brown hare that runs across the fields. I don't know how many people have seen recently. Should be there. We have the grasshopper. Okay, was there. They're going to be chewing at the leaves quite a lot and coming back. We have a what's called a shield bug. In that case, and that one again is feeding on the leaves. I'll say something else. Yes, we do. We've got another picture of the shield bugs later on, I think, and looking at them. But they're basically of a group that are called the Hemiptera, and they're young again, are able to, as larvae, feed on different parts of the plant. But the adults will feed and make holes in the leaves as well. Silver wire moth there, and is caterpillar. Quite often a lot of the moths don't actually feed as adults. Some do, but some don't. And all their energy is basically taken from your caterpillar. What are they? Digestive bags. They chew, and they digest, and they grow. And then they what we call pupate and turn into the adult. And that's how we end up with dispersal and mating, the variation that's caused. So we end up with the larvae, which we'll see, again, a different job, a difficult job identifying them all as we go through the whole procedure. How do we know that's a silver? Well, there are keys and you learn what they're actually like in the end. Another one there, that's another type of plant bug, the myriad group. Again, it's going to have a really long proboscis mouth part that sticks into the plant leaves and basically sucks individual cells of the actual plant. Most of these plants, or some of them, will be able to get into the phloem and continue to suck the actual sugars that have been produced by the plant. So there's a variety of different feeding techniques in the different insects. That's partly what makes them interesting as a group and so diverse. You must recognise that one, Ian. But the plant underneath it, bane of your life. Well, things eat it. Yes, the cinnabar moth larvae. Why are they nice and brightly striped? Well, they're poisonous. The birds don't want to eat them. Why? Because the ragwort itself has produced the alkaloids, the actual poisons, taken on board by the actual cinnabar moth larvae, and utilised. They manage to avoid the poisonous effects of that chemical and have just used it as tasting unpleasant to the rest of any predator wanting to eat them. But you can see masses of them on the ragwort. Maybe we'll have less cinnabar moth now if we keep on going. And that's the adult cinnabar moth. Come back in. If you ever see them around, that's what, which one it is. Other bits, even at the hedgerows, and I'm sure you've been planting holly, well, you quite often see these things called mimes. And this is the holly leaf miner. Each different species of plant might have a different leaf miner in it. And what's the adult, which is a type of fly here, lays its egg just by the midrib here, and then the egg hatches into the larva, and that fact starts to burrow its way through and eats between the upper layer and the lower layer, eats the middle out of the leaf. And you see these particular patches on all of the leaves. It then pupates in that, and it's a really nice story because you can see whether the birds actually take that, because holly is keeps its leaves all year, obviously. Well, it's evergreen, all right, yeah, fair enough. It's not like those. It's evergreen. You can actually work out how old a leaf is from that distance back from the tip. And it keeps a story of what's happened to that particular leaf there. You can find out if the actual fly larva pupated and escaped by the exit hole from it. You can find out for birds eating it. But also, they're parasitized. There's another type of wasp which will actually lay its eggs through the hole and find the grub, right? And that will go and eat the grub out. And then when that emerges, you can actually look at the history of the leaf and so say, oh, that one was parasitized, as opposed to the bird that got that one, oh, that one escaped, that was a good one. If you want holes in your leaf or mines in your leaves. But it becomes a fascinating story. And the other one that I know was working in your department, because Don Whittaker worked on it, the green dock leaf beetle. It produces holes in the dock leaves, and it's both the adult green beetle there will eat the leaf, and it will lay its eggs on the stem, and it will form another mine in the side. So a beetle will form mines, as well as flies forming mines, or fly larvae. But it's a good source of food. They're different, fascinating stories behind each group. And so we get lots of different series of organisms. I'm sure you recognise the goldfinch there, seed eating. It's in all the hedgerows, it's there looking for, in fact, very fine small seeds all the way around. We end up with small mammals, of which that's, I think, the short-tailed vole. I don't know how common they are yet. We haven't done a small mammal survey at all to see what's there and find out how many are there. But if you've got kestrels and other things looking for them, they're going to be there. I'm sure they're there. How many and what sort of density, I don't know at the moment. You've got the weevils. Different type of beetle, great big long snout. They're usually burrowing into seed material as opposed to actual leaf material. Different sites have got real biting mouth parts at the end of that great big long proboscis. Different varieties of them are usually after the seeds. Other type, normal, you've got the lapwing there, and another type of bug, the Hemiptera bugs, that are able, in this case, they're not just the ones that will kind of pierce the leaves, but there are roots that, in this case, will go straight into the seeds. A variety of different, in fact, feeding formats for the insects, and it's more than enough, not just naming them, saying, oh, I've got that, but finding out what they're about. So moving up a level, what eats what? We end up with the biting mouth parts. That's an aphid, so this is a friend. You might think that the aphids you don't really want in your garden, they're plant suckers, okay? So anything that eats the aphid is good for you. We've got the ladybird that does the same job. That actually is the hoverfly larva. And the hoverflies that you see flying around there, the young are predators, usually. There are anything I should say, there's usually exceptions to. So it's very broad generalisations here. But on the whole, these larvae there are predators and getting rid of things like stationary aphids that just sit there. Well, they try to run away, but the predators are much quicker. We've got the Staphylinid beetles. Rose beetles? Staphylinid beetles there, which are predators. The standard ground beetle is there looking for anything it can, like clembler, bits and pieces. It will even take some bits of grass, but normally odd. Anything small in itself will end up scavenging, and they are quite common around. We've got these stag beetles there, massive, great mouth parts associated with things that you wouldn't really want to meet, but they're somewhere around within different types of habitats. I would expect to see them particularly associated with kind of wood piles and other habitat features that we can look at. And it's not just the adults that are predators, but quite often the larvae. So a lot of the beetle larvae here, great big biting mouthparts. And this one at the moment is, I can't remember what it's actually the grub of, but again, they're predators they're getting rid of. Lots of, a variety of anything that's smaller than normally. You can think of it as the clembelins, but there's lots of other little bits that are around. And still we've got more, because lots of different varieties. Okay, we've got the lizards around, and a smooth snake. Smooth snake. So we've got the amphibians represented. We've got the group of centipedes as predators. The ones with one pair of legs per segment, okay, and they move quickly, they'll be the predators, like garden friendly organisms. The ones that are slowly, normally two pairs of legs per segment, and they would tend to be the plant eaters, the ones that take the crops that you want at home in the garden. So, but there's a variety of different types of those. A wolf spider, saw those the other day, now they're just about coming out running on the surface. This one's got an egg sac behind it. And that egg sac would have 40, 50 eggs in that eventually hatch out, and then the female carries them on her back, on the abdomen, for about a week or so before the tiny little spiders can then separate and move away from the parent. They'll take a year to grow up, to mature, and then usually in April, May time is where we see them most commonly running on the surface of the vegetation. They don't build webs. The web builders are things like that and our garden spider variety. This is, it's been recorded in the last insect survey, is what we call the long pout, common name, orb weaver. It's Enoplognatha, I think is the genus name for it. That's there, and then we've got another type of predator, the harvester, the ones with the long legs by the side, but got four pairs of legs. Didn't find a picture there. But yes, it's got a little eyes, a little pivot. There's lots of different types of the arachnids that are all predators and quite different. Interesting there. We've got our pipistrelle bats. You go up into the atmosphere that was there, all the different variety we have, and of course, I haven't seen the record of a hedgehog there, but I'm sure it will be. Actually, in the lists, it's just a matter of finding them. But again, looking at the, I think we've recorded at least two different types of the pipistrelle there, and there should be others if we're there at the right time and doing the recording and finding out. But you'll see them flying around at dusk between the trees. And hence, what you're probably more familiar with, what are we there for? Is it just to encourage the birds and the large insects, the dragonflies, flying around? Dramatic sights, and that's what people remember. But they've got to eat something. It's what is underneath that actually supports them and allows them to be there. And hence the types of plants that are there in the end. So what do we need to be able to have? We're looking for lots of different habitats. Gives you a greater ability to have different types of organisms there. And hence habitat diversity. We can get there and make the different styles there, we increase the number of species. Even if at the moment at the bottom of Gleeson's Field, okay, we've got dead grass there, this was in Sourholme, it hasn't been raised much at all, very little improvement, but the grass should be 2-3 feet high. The space, the three-dimensional habitat around there, and of course, therefore, all the seed heads that are produced from the grasses provide food for a variety of different organisms. when the cows have eaten the rest and trodden them, you don't get those. And that's, in fact, where the careful management has got to come in. And of course we've got aquatic habitats as well. I think that's the bottom of Anna's Pond, for those people that get wellies on and can find it. Or we've been trying to fix the dam. Is it Salty Bay? No. You'll know it. Okay, so we've got the hedgerows, the trees around there. And we've also got the woodland system. We've got our pony wood at the top there. And that's actually little wood by the side, because I could get there quite easily. But the habitat there provides a different group of organisms and therefore a different set of insects that are available. When a tree is felled, what should we do? Remove it, which is the normal system. We need to leave it there as habitat. And hence, in the odd stems that are in pony wood, you can see evidence of the insects. And in fact, birds taking the insects. Right? Also, it's starting to decompose. We've got our arachid fungi in there. Don't see it, but yeah, there's a massive, most of this will be full of the hyphae, slowly decomposing the actual timber. And that bracket that you can see on the side of the trees is the equivalent of the toadstool or the mushroom, just producing the spores. Most of it is hidden inside the tree. So what's produced the holes? You get another type of beetle that's in there, and wood boring insects, and they lay their eggs in there, and it's the larvae which normally do all the chewing, and hence, and therefore in some cases can carry disease to the tree. But just like the holly leaf miner, we can have parasites. There are a group of wasps called the ichneumon wasps, and this one has got a great big long, from the back, what we call an ovipositor, drills down into the wood because somehow these antennae can sense where that grub is in the middle of the wood. It then drills down with its ovipositor and lays an egg in the grub. Don't know how it does it. Interesting to find out. But a whole group, if you look at the flies, there's a history behind each of them and see what we've actually got. But not just woodland, we've got our ponds, it's wet. Right? Fraser said that he collected the watercress that's growing in the Lucy Brook. I don't know whether I really want to eat it, but the water's looking quite clear at the moment, it's quite good. And there's a lot of watercress there. Which pond's that one? I can't remember. Alright, so what's in the aquatic system? It's in Soho, okay, there's lots of wet sogginess. All the different plants there, okay, you've got lots of mosses there. Duckweed you can see around, and Martin, can you remember? What's commonly there? Can't remember. Okay, go and name all the different plants, or different exercise. But back to bacteria, you look around there, oh, somebody's polluted it. No, they haven't. That's microbial decomposition. And it's producing in anaerobic conditions when there's not much air. Quite often we'll produce oil-based compounds. Hydrocarbons that have come onto the surface. And, okay, it's nothing to worry about. It's part of the normal system. It's a wetland system. It's quite normal. It's along with another one, you often see a lot of the red colours coming out of the oxidation state of iron compounds that have come out from the vegetation there. And that's quite normal. It's no problem. That's what we look for, because that's dramatic. We've got our chasers, okay? And that's a damselfly, and back to the normal hawker dragonfly. Dramatic things, different flying patterns. Lots of going across the water. And all of these are actually predators. These the hawkers will actually catch the insects, they're after small insects, come on to a minute, in their legs at the front. When they're in the mid-flight, going around, and managed to eat them seemingly when they're still flying, which is quite remarkable. And hawk is in a slightly different catching mode, fair enough. So, diagram, what's in pond life? I didn't put a camera underneath the water and do it all. But, okay, we've got our water scorpions. There's different type of beetle living underneath the water surface. A tube at the back end can go to the surface to breathe air, right? Because they're all, in fact, air breathers. And again, that as a scorpion, it looks like it's because it's got the tail, but it's really an air breathing tube. Water boatmen, you see, swim on the backs. They're not beetles. They're actually like the bugs. They're Hemiptera, in the Hemiptera group. But again, predators in this case, eating all the other small bits of pond life, but not just the microbes there, but things like, you might have heard of Daphnia, you can buy them in the fish shop. Okay, that sort of thing that's got to grow up in the water. The diving beetle we've recorded there, Linda picked one up last summer sometime in the pond. That's the adult. You've got the larvae there, massive predators, and tremendous game beetles. But we've also got mosquito larvae, pupae, okay? We'll come back to those in a moment. Rat-tailed maggots. They look like fly larvae. Well, they are. They're larvae are actually more hoverflies, living in the bottom of the pond. And the actual tail again goes to the surface to be able to breathe the air. So there's a better picture of our mosquito larvae. Right, food for anything else that you like, and your mosquito looks like a fat one. It looks like it's fed recently. And the mouth part, that little thing folded there is the cover to the mouth part, and the tube goes straight down. And of course, the mosquito, you don't feel it, and the blood doesn't clot because it produces it's actually very sensitive. It will find out where your nerve endings are and miss them, but will find the capillary and plug into it and put the anti-clotting agent in first, so it makes sure it gets a good meal for the whole time that it feeds on you. But there are also little things, midges, okay, lots of them. The larvae here of the so-called non-light biting midges, we call them bloodworms. Why are they red? They've got hemoglobin in, which is the pigment we have in our red blood cells. It carries oxygen. But they've developed it as well, or used it, to be able to make sure they can live in areas of the pond which are really quite horrible, we call them with less oxygen in. And that hemoglobin, the red colour in, allows them to take the oxygen, the small amount of oxygen there is there, out of the water and survive. Right? Whereas other organisms might not be able to do that. And that's the adult. You look closely, the antennae are superb. That's a male. And the male will actually be able to hunt out females and pheromones, as well as be able to find its own food source, usually from carbon dioxide sources, but they don't actually bite us. Those are the ones that bite us. Again, the young live in water. That's the larva of it. And it's a standard fly. One pair of wings and a pair of what we call halteres and a great big biting thing. You can't see them, they're so small. But they bite you and you react to it. And it's fair enough. But we'll see them biting indeed. Frogs, toads, get rid of all the, as predators, get rid of some of the insects. We've got another Hemiptera and the pond skaters, you'll see around there. Whirligig beetles. Most of these are actually predators, along with our newts that we know that they're the common newt. So, what do we need to be able to look at? If we can create the conditions and get the habitat right, you will get the variety of life that you want. Presumably, the bit that it is there, and that those plants will be specific, they'll thrive. And so, if we want a specific one, you've got to look for its food plant, understand the organism, and make sure that that is there. And then you'll get the different types. More habitats, different wood piles, different piles, all different variety of things. You increase the species list, and therefore more choice and more predators will be in there, which is the ones that we often see. But just as a thought, what we have got here into the middle of Lancaster is a corridor of green, of in fact, countryside coming in. And a lot of the news at the moment about why we should allow farming, or farmers should have strips, for example, either side of hedgerows for 10 metres, 20 metres, to allow of untreated, non-farmed land that can allow all these organisms to be able to migrate from one area to another. The continuous nature of the land is essential to keep the populations healthy. Species richness of that hay meadow, even compared to that with Gleeson's field or the other fields, yes, there is much more of a monoculture plant than the flora fields, which we need to do something about.
Yeah, just following on, not as much as one would think. The hay meadow is now developing a diversity of species. That's largely because we put them there.
Well,
now, the big meadow, the big pasture,
yeah.
I have walked that field inch by inch for the last 3 years, and there's hardly anything in terms of, I'm sure there are lots of grasses that I don't recognise, but very few wildflowers.
Yes,
for an area that wasn't fertilised, and obviously it is now grazed by cattle, and they their own fertilisation system, but I'm surprised how little there is.
One thing that, of course, with the cattle there, you never see the diversity unless you could recognise vegetative features, because they're not allowed to flower. If you actually took the cattle off entirely for the year, you would see more variety than is apparent.
Oh, I thought that was what the sheep did, but the cattle were rather more selective. Am I being naive?
No, I mean, sheep will raise down to a very low level and keep a very short sword. And they'll end up also puddling or making the soil more compact in a different way to the cattle. Cattle are heavy with larger, if like, feet, but they are individual. They will produce more undulation within the field compared to sheep. They are also, I accept that they are more selective, yes. But in looking at it overall, they would keep the flowering system down and take all the heads off most of the time.
I think there was a difference between big meadow and the wildflower meadow that we're creating before we started putting wildflowers in. It had much more variety of grass than the other fields.
I mean, partly it's drier, which does help. As soon as you get the soggy conditions in a big meadow.
You said at the start about the fertility of some of the fields and the need to reduce that. What sort of time scale are we going to be looking at?
It's probably... It's ending up looking at decades. The only way to increase it is to continue to take the crop off and discard the crop, take it away. Because by removing something from the whole system, as opposed to allowing it to recycle on site, that's the only way to remove the nutrients. And unfortunately, naturally, rainfall produces quite a lot of nutrients into a system. If it, where does a non-agricultural system get its nutrients from? Whatever it's got gets recycled, but some would be leaching out from the soil into the streams and rivers at all the time. That loss is replaced, usually by rainfall.
Normally, the proper management of the orchard is to trim it and mow it. Should we be very careful to take those trimmings and mowings off and make specific heaps on them rather than having a generalised return of fertility? So you've got to actually sort of almost compost it in conditions for different.
It depends what you want to do. Are you thinking of then returning the compost down the trees? Because presumably the trees are. The orchard is a productive system that you want the fertility for the trees to grow well.
Yeah.
And hence, spreading it and just leaving it underneath the pit will allow, keep the nutrient if not underneath the tree that's there.
Yeah.
If you take it away to compost it and not put it back, it will reduce the crop potential.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, probably, but at the moment, it seems to be overall the net.
But that's a lot of fertility.
Yeah.
Classic indicators of high phosphorus.
So high fertility.
Nettles require high fertility usually. Yes. Indicators are.
I was going to ask, how do you sample ground and make a list of what organisms and animals are in there?
A lot of care and attention. Hopefully,
it's
the variety of different techniques. There's one that they call kind of sweep, to get anything from the vegetation, one called sweep netting, where you take a net and you just bash the ground, bash through the crop, collect them, and then try and catch whatever before it flies away, goes away, or does anything else, or bites you. If you're looking at stuck within your flat leaflet, right underneath the normal herbs, normal grass, you either have to do it by hand searching, which is hands and knees and quite painful, or you can take samples of it and start to shake it, extract it, or there are techniques of course of heat extraction, where for small areas of soil, tops, few centimetres of soil, you'll slowly dry them out. And all the animals then move away into a collecting tray, which takes a lot of time. It's semi-destructive, looking at it. There are then things called pitfall traps. Anything active on the surface, in theory, could run into a cup that you leave there. So there's a variety of different techniques to use.
From what you just answered to one of these chaps there, it sounds like we're not going to get wildflowers showing for decades. Is that what you...
They will come slowly.
So it's a very long
time. It's a long... It's not something, we'll do it next year. We are, of course, speeding up the system by seeding. Specific seeding.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the wildflower meadow, when we took it over, was getting down to the levels of fertility where it was going to work. There's clearly reasons for them beyond and much higher.
Slowly down year after year.
Yeah.
There are other ways of increasing wildflower growth by managing areas, for example, coppicing, although you're not necessarily reducing the fertility, you maybe don't want to in there. But the fact that you're allowing more light and air in there will bring the flowers out, won't it?
Oh yes, if you start with a woodland, you can then kind of clear or coppice a particular area, suddenly the seed bank that is already there has a chance to be able to germinate and grow up and introduce a glade situation, a different habitat basically, with the light available there. Most of what we're talking about is field situations anyway, and it's not a change from woodland to an open field system.
I've noticed even on the hedge layer, not the hedges, as we've been doing. you see it by perception that the wild flowers, the spring flowers, are much more prominent.
Yeah.
And that's a way of getting enough, obviously, slightly different aspect to reducing the fertility. But there's lots of different other management techniques to maximise what you've got, isn't it?
It's nice that you've kind of noticed that already from the actual, the hedge laying we've done in the last 2 years, effectively.
Could I just ask Martin a question? Martin, because you took part in the BioBlitz last year, and do you have a view about this number of species in the former area compared to similar habitats that you aren't familiar with? Am I putting you too much on the spot by asking a question about that?
What's a similar habitat? How similar do you want?
Well, it's also
very
wet and marshy, isn't it?
It is, yes.
I just want to say, if you had just an overall view about how we're doing.
Well, I don't know how you're doing, because I haven't seen it dynamically, so how it's changing, I really have no idea. I mean, it's fairly normal farmland, I would have said, as a sweeping generalisation. It's rather wetter than they've obviously not drained it as well as most farmland these days, which is sourced good because you get different plants in better areas than you do in drier areas.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, just does a wide variety of plants there though. Mm-hmm. No.
Okay.
That was my question. Yeah. And Chris, you were talking of variety of habitats, and you pointed out that we have various kinds of habitats. Are there others that you want to be trying to encourage that you don't have, or you would just be sticking with what you've got and improving?
I think as a basic point, we've probably got a reasonable range. But things like your log files or areas, I know Linda suggested to encourage either in some of the reptiles or amphibians there, a series of mats or some cover for the ground that gives them protection and probably kills quite a bit of the vegetation underneath, but finally produces a different style of habitat. She was looking for the areas for newts and slow worms and the small reptiles and amphibians there.
A useful technique of increasing the vulnerable bees and also the mammals is simply to dig a small hole, a handful from the tile of it.
Yeah.
And if you did that along the hedgerows, we can greatly increase the vulnerable bees as well.
Just
handful scrape and a tile on top. Just to keep it dry.
A roof tile type thing, just something.
Can I just ask, do you think that there's any effect of how close we are to the sea? I remember about 20 years ago, we got quite a lot of salt burn in the garden. A lot of plants were affected. There must have been a storm that blew up. And we live the sort of distance from the sea that's sort of midway through this area. I just wonder whether this has an effect on the diversity of plants. I know it's a rare event, but you know if you walk on salt wash, there's very little there.
I think there's insufficient salt, but it's not frequent enough to make it into any sort of brackish area. I think we're fairly safe, other than the storm situation where you suddenly get the wind burn and the salt coming up into the air. Yes, some years ago I remember my hedgerow suddenly went all brown at the edges. It wasn't like frost, it was something else that suddenly heated.
Yeah. Rather specific question. We tried to stop ragwort seeding by pulling it out and by selective purposes. But how long does seed from a plant like that remain active in the ground? Is it 5 years? 10 years?
Oh,
you'll
get it forever.
The German hedges talk about the pyramids.
Well, the ragwort itself, I don't know, but the chances are it's a fairly tough plant, and it's going to be a fairly long time.
Thank you.
The only thing that would generate is the pyramids is a myth, but seems to certainly last for decades.
Do you know,
I don't know how viable ragwort seed is, but yes, I mean, yeah, as you say, it's a persistent weed. It's unlikely to be a short time. Yeah. The gardener's rule is 1 year's weeding is seeding is 7 years weeding, but that's garden weeds. But yes, I mean, I think seven years is probably a conservative. Maybe 10, 12 years.
Can I ask you a health and safety, question? Are we likely to have ticks?
If you get rougher ground. As the plants go up, do you increase the number of ticks?
Yes.
Yes, you would.
Right.
Yes, they'll deer through.
Are they carrying ticks today?
Well, the deer will.
Small mammals will.
Drop lots of grass, don't they?
Cattle,
probably as well.
There will be some, yes.
Okay, right. That's on the list. Are there other questions? If not, I'm going to thank Chris. Some people may want to congregate afterwards and ask more specific things. I think Mick has a couple of things that he wants to say, but I'd just like to thank Chris for giving this overview of what we're trying to achieve. I'm partly fascinated by the whole pattern of it all, and partly feel terribly responsible. I mean, I thought 5 grandchildren was enough, but I suddenly feel very responsible. There's thousands of species that are dependent on flora and fauna for their survival.
Could be.
It has been fascinating to see how interconnected everything is, so thank you very much.
Before you all go, 2 things. 1, an announcement, so that's quick and I'll do that fast. You remember last time I asked people about field walking. We were talking about looking for finding after the ploughing. We've now managed to get the archaeologist from the University of Central Lancashire, who's going to help us do it in a reasonably efficient sort of way. She's come up and had a look around with Sue and I, and the consequence of that is that we're actually going to put off the field walking until next spring, so we won't be doing it this spring, which means that we've got more time to organise ourselves. We'll be sending an email out to all of those people who signed up to come and do field walking. And we'll tell you a bit more about that as the year progresses. The other thing I wanted to talk about very quickly and to ask your views about is something that's kind of happened during today, really, and it's a bit of a conundrum for us. Dave has suggested that it might be a good idea if I just mentioned it to you all, because we have to make some decisions rather fast, and we're not quite sure what to do. We have been assuming up until now, because various people were very against the idea of having herbicide on the fields, that we would not do general herbicide spraying, and indeed we had decided to go for deep ploughing as a way of reducing the weeds in the area that we're going to have an arable crop in. And I thought everything was going on okay for that, and the farmer had agreed to plough the field and was going to do it in the first week in April. Then today I phoned him up to talk about when exactly this ploughing was going to be done, because there are various things we have to do to make sure that they plough it in the way that we want it to be ploughed, and all that stuff in the lint chips and so on. And first of all, he said, well, he would like to put lime on the field, and I did contact various people over that, including our English Heritage advisor, and she said it was okay for us to put lime on it, so that's okay, we'll do that. But then immediately he then came back and said something that he'd said before, but had accepted we didn't want to do it, namely that he wants to put herbicide on the field, he's consulted various people, he says, and he says that if we don't spray the field with herbicide and he takes the crop off at the end of the season in order to feed it to his cattle, which was basically the way we were going to be able to fund it, he was going to do the work, he was going to get the crop, so there would be relatively little financial cost to us in it. He's now saying that his agronomist has told him that if he does that, then basically all of the seeds for the weeds on our land will get transferred to his land, and then he will have to use even more herbicide on his land next year in order to control those crops. And so he's, I mean, we don't have exactly this situation yet, but he's clearly pushing us towards having herbicide in a rather massive way, in the way that various people were very against. Or we end up, I think, paying him just to do the ploughing, and presumably we have to just compost the crop. Or we end up not ploughing at all, and instead we just have more cattle on the land. And it looks as if we're going to have to make this decision really very fast, and there's not going to be much time to consult anybody because of the time in which the crops have to be certain. So I just thought it would be a good idea to get reactions from the people here tonight to see what they thought. So.
I think there's one factor which influences me considerably, which is that our RSPB advisor, Richard Stockton, recommends this farm to us. And Richard has been a very strong ally of the Fairfield Association, and I put a lot of weight on his opinion. He knows this farmer. The farmer is working in a, not only is an organic farmer, but he is an environmentally friendly farmer. He comes with that recommendation. I think the other point which is consistent with that is that this issue of if you don't use herbicide, you just get swamped with weeds, is the advice that's been given by Natural England, even by Bill Grayson, I think, who had a way around it because he used another form of subsidy to basically cope with the cost of all the weeds. So it's going to happen. And if we don't deal with it, if we don't bite that bullet, we'll just be inundated with weeds. Of course, we could just say, all right, we'll just leave the cattle on. But that would have to be forever. Because whenever we try to take the cattle off and put it to arable, then this problem would arise. So my view is we should bite the bullet. As I understand it, it's for 1 year when we would need this preventative herbicide. Once we've basically tackled the problem, we can move in a more organic direction. I don't think you can simply move from very heavily fertilised fields, and we know that they fertilise them 3 times a year for as long as I've known this area. I don't think you can move in one fell swoop from heavily fertilised land to organic land without just being swamped by weeds.
Is it the requirement for herbicides simply because we're growing a cereal crop? What about growing another crop like field beans or peas or something like that? They can still be used for silage, but we wouldn't need to use the herbicides.
That was by growing. We're not here to be farming a crop. The really great cereal is to actually increase the diversity of wildlife, and a field bean and that sort of crop would not do that. So I would suggest not. And I'd also like, in support of what Ian is saying, that Yes, in principle, I wouldn't want to use herbicide. If we are wanting to achieve our aims, as Chris has been pointing out tonight, as a diverse nature reserve, and we do have to bite the bullet at this time and explain very eloquently to people why this is the case. And in support of using the herbicide, we are having advice from experts, from our Natural England advisor, and from the RSPB, who also farm cereal crops themselves. If we don't do this, we could end up not achieving what Natural England have given us funding to do. So we would lose everything and end up with just grassland.
Chris,
Chris as well. Chris, do you want to say something? I was going to say, would the use of herbicide include the beetle bank, sorry, the steep cast on the side of it, or just the area he's going to plough?
Well, I mean, what he's wanting to do is boom spray a lot. Yeah. And of course, what we have been saying is that because various people have argued so vociferously against herbicide, that what we would do would be to do spot spraying to, you know, control the nettles and so on, and presumably we would either avoid the beetle banks altogether or spot spray in particular broadleaf plants in order to control it. I'm not trying to give an answer because I genuinely don't know what to do, and we're going to have to sort this in like a couple of days, so it's a big issue for us. Sorry,
what's the purpose of the plough land?
Well, the theory behind it, and it was Richard Staughton who originally proposed it, we sort of assumed that we would just have cattle grazing on it, but more often when we got more land. But he wanted us to have an arable crop because he thought it would be particularly good for the wetland and weaning birds. He thought there was a decent chance that we would get some of those birds, maybe lapwing if we were really lucky, back into those fields actually nesting in there. Because the good thing about the arable crop, if you sow it in the spring, as we want to do, is that first of all the birds get something to eat when they're hungry, and then secondly, as the crop grows up a little, it's the right kind of height for the birds to nest. If it gets too high, then they can't stand up and look around and see whether the predators are around. So it was that kind of idea that led us to the kind of management plan that we put in place.
So the herbicide shouldn't affect that. It's not just using insecticide, which would be detrimental.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we're wanting to do is not use insecticide and not use this boom spray herbicide. We're trying to get away with something that was less than that. It's not as good as for those people who argue that we should have no herbicide or pesticide whatsoever on anything. And there was an enormous, very heated debate about it in one of the Fairfield Association meetings. And we're trying to find a way of steering between, you know, these two different sets of views and advice that we're getting. But suddenly the rug's been pulled under our feet from that, and we have to work out what to do.
What is the nature of this herbicide? Does it have an effect on humans, for example? Because I live quite near
that field. I think it's almost certainly going to be glyphosate, isn't it?
So it's used in the garden, awful warnings on it.
Yeah. But only if you get it on your skin before.
Well, that was bound to blow in the wind, isn't it?
I
just wondered how important it is that we actually do things this year. How does that affect if we decided to say, look, can we have another year to think about, to do research into it? Does that affect the grant and so on? One reason that I asked that is when some time ago you asked if amongst members there were, you know, we knew anybody who could plough, and one of the people that I asked, as you know, was a professor of soil science at the university, because Philip thought that he would know a sort of friendly farmer in the area who do this. And one of the things that the professor professor of soil science said to me, who knows the thing, is that, well, you can only plant this sort of crop, the barley or oats, what it is, for so long that you have to have things on rotation. So he said, you know, you still, in 2 or 3 years, would come back to a situation where you would have to put it back to grass again.
Yeah.
Even though I was explaining that what we wanted, or what we've been advised to do, is grow a crop for the birds, not for us to make any income out of it. And he himself, as a professor of soil science, didn't understand why we were going to plough that particular land, because he said, well, as Chris has said today, it hasn't been ploughed for like 400 years. There's a reason for it. It's very damp, and he was very concerned that it end up with a very wet and manageable land. You know, I'd explain that it was...
Some of it's damp, some of it's less damp. I mean, it's got a
right,
hill,
so... Yeah. So I just wondered, you know, are we able to have a year to think about it?
Well, I mean, we can try and ask that of Claire Narrows tomorrow. It's just that we really don't
yeah.
have much time. It may be that she can give us some kind of derogation in order to cope with the situation. But, I mean, essentially, the kind of system we were going for, I think, is much like the one the professor you were talking to
mm.
is talking about. It's bound to be the case that you have to rotate the crops.
Yeah.
And then... it's bound also to be the case that there will be years when the land has to be fallow, because
yeah.
that's the traditional system that
yeah.
it essentially we go back to. So we're assuming that's going to happen.
Yeah.
We wanted it to start this year because you know, that was the pattern that we established, and we thought we were okay with it, but
mm.
suddenly we're not. So that's what I'm trying to work
it's
out.
It's just that
then
if you have years when your birds can't fall, they just
yeah, well, that's right. I mean, clearly you wouldn't be attracting, you know, lapwing and birds of that sort of in there this year if you end up not ploughing, don't you? And what the Natural England advisor says is that we must plough the land this year. That's what she says. She says that if we don't manage to get a crop on it, that's maybe not such a problem for this year. I mean, she was already talking about the possibility of us maybe not being able to have a crop because it was so wet.
Mm.
But she still said that what we needed to do was plough, because she wanted as much as possible of the land to be inverted in order to reduce the possibility of weeds growing back through. But there are too many moving parts.
Yeah,
I can't control what's going on at the moment.
If you're using herbicide, there's actually no need to plough because you kill the plants anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ethical techniques of non-ploughing, allowing cumes to build up, and they just soak through all the dead plant material.
I think we've gone through this
yeah,
winter, Chris, and that's not. I think, you know, the herbicide, it is an emotional. Emotions, I understand, but we would not be being advised by Natural England and the RSPB to herbicide if there was going to be any long-term damage. We will also, if we don't plough and remove the grass, there will be no field margins as we're wanting to have. There will be no leaves, there will be no flowers on those, and we won't have the corridors that Chris has mentioned either. So, possible, I think, the ploughing, the herbicide of the ploughing for the year is a much more positive, if that's the plus side, I would say. Otherwise, you're back to square one.
Yeah, I mean, my personal views are not that far away from yours, I think, Tony. I argued who were saying no herbicide entirely in the first place, because the advice of the Natural England people is to put herbicide in the first year.
Can I ask if should we just ask for a different comments because of the time we are?
Yeah, so yes. Ian.
Were you saying that the farmer would plough, but he would have to do once he took the material to his own farm, he would then have to treat what we've given him with the...
No, he's not saying that he would treat the crop that he took off, but that because his cattle would eat the crop and the seeds would end up through the feces of the cattle on his fields, he would then have to be putting in more herbicide than he's currently putting in order to do it. So he's in effect kind of pushing us into making a decision of the sort that he wants, in spite of the fact that we had an arrangement whereby it wasn't going to happen. I feel a bit as if I'm just being bounced, and that's part of it, and I don't know enough in order to be able to make the decision. I'm not a farmer, I just don't know enough.
Well, if we offered to pay for his extra fertiliser at his farm, rather than on our
farm... No, you can't do that because that defeat to... What is, that's the one that's not in my backyard. This is a farmer, he farms environmentally, so we are saying, well, we don't want a herbicide now, but we don't care if you put it on yours.
Well, now let's not have an extended kind of debate about all sorts of general things. Let's kind of fix on the particular issue.
Yes, sorry, but he, again, advice, we've got that thing about how it's been, I understand this farm, which has been recommended to it by Richard at the RSPB. He farms environmentally. These are experts. We know nothing about
it. Yeah, but hang on a minute. I mean, he agreed to farm, you know, to do the work in the way that we wanted it to be done,
right.
And suddenly he's saying, no, the situation
right.
has changed, my
right.
conditions have changed.
Right.
That's the thing that's worrying me,
right.
I feel as though I'm being bounced. Yes, sir.
Right.
Just a small point, we're not simply ploughing for the arable crop, but also for the wildflower
yes,
margins,
yes.
Which is my particular concern and my particular regret if we just revert to pasture land, because as I said earlier, there's surprisingly little wildflowers in the pasture land that we have.
Mm-hmm. I think what Ian and Tony have just said to be really interesting and sort of illuminating, and I think, given as you say, the people from Natural England and RSPB are people who are the experts in this, because all we can say is, well, we've taken guidance from as many members as possible. Like I say, being bounced into this.
One of the other difficulties that I have is that Richard Staughton, who found the farm for us, and who has never himself said anything about us having to put herbicide on the crop, but the farmer is now saying that Richard has said that to him, that kind of makes me worry, why wouldn't Richard have said it to us? But Richard isn't here at the moment, he's on holiday, so there is no way of being able to check up on any of those things. So there's another kind of issue in there to do with communication and fact gathering that makes it quite difficult to work out what to do. Could I just ask people to vote? I mean, it doesn't mean anything particularly, but I just want to kind of get a feel for what people think.
Yes.
So let's think of some possibilities. So one is that we just leave the field as it is and have the cattle graze it this year. That's one possibility, isn't it? A second is that we make the farmer plough it, but we refuse to put the herbicide on, and then we try and grow the crop and probably end up throwing it away. And the third one is that we agree to the herbicide position. So that, those three reasonably clear? Okay, so who's...
Isn't the first essentially a delay of the year? Is
I don't know. How can I know?
Well, I postponed it to the decision.
Well, it really sort of postpones the decision, doesn't it?
Gives us an opportunity to find somewhere
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
We have
yet to know whether Natural
yeah.
England would be happy with it. And,
yeah.
and I can't know that until I've contacted anybody.
Has your farmer just being given advice, or is this something in his own mind?
I've no idea. Absolutely no idea. Well, his view has always been that the land should have herbicide thrown all over it. I mean, he view has always been that.
But then he
agreed to do what was said. Richard talked to him about it, and he agreed that it was okay. And when we first had the meeting with him, he said, well, he thought that the crop wouldn't be as good as he would expect it to be, and therefore we might end up having to pay him money because he wouldn't be able, you know, to get as much out of the field as he thought he would be able to. And clearly he has costs in doing the ploughing, providing the seed, and so on. But now, suddenly, he's saying all these other things, which he hasn't said before.
Well, this is why I wanted to know if he's actually been talking to somebody else.
Well, he has been talking to an advisor, but I don't know what the advisor said, I wasn't there. So, they're kind of issues that I don't have enough control over to be able to to give you an accurate answer. Yes, Anna.
Can I ask, is there a cost for the herbicide?
Yes.
Would it be offset if we didn't buy the herbicide and we didn't have to pay the farmer? Oh no, he ploughs and he doesn't get the crops to throw it away.
Yeah, there are costs in all of these things. So if let's pretend he doesn't get the crop, then we have to pay him to plough and to harrow the land and also to plant the seeds. Right? And then, of course, he's going to come and cut the crop off in, say, the middle of August, and we have to pay him for that. And if we use herbicide, we have to pay for the herbicide, and we don't actually know the cost of any of these things. Because we thought that what we had was an arrangement whereby he was going to do the work and he was going to get the crop, and no money will change hands. But now suddenly we could be in a position where there are, quite a lot of thousands of pounds moving around.
Isn't
he No. What farmers are like. I've been asking him to provide costings, and I haven't got them. That's another issue. I'm not going to get into that.
Are you sure we have to pay for the herbicide? My impression when I originally spoke to him getting on for a year ago now was that he would include that as part of the service, if you like.
That's possible, somebody would have to pay for it. I suppose that's what I was really meaning. So if you end up with an arrangement whereby it's no money changes hands and part of what he provides, after all he will be providing the seed. So he will be providing the herbicide as well, I suppose. But because we don't actually know what the effects are, it's very difficult to know the answer to that question. Can I go back to the things I was asking you to vote on and see if we can get some kind of general sense of what people feel? So,
can I just ask on the money side? Does the grant that we'd be getting from the Natural Forest, does that cover?
No, it won't, I don't think. I mean, we get bits of money for lots of different things. The money that we get, doesn't seem by and large to pay for whatever needs to be done. It's a contribution towards it. Then there are some bits of money that are kind of free, so we can have educational access and we get bits of money for that, so we can use that to offset other things. We thought that we were going to be able to get single payment subsidies from the SVS scheme that the government runs, but they're changing the rules on that, and it looks as if we may well not be able to get that money because we won't count as farmers under the new rules. That would have enabled us to subsidise the other activities, so we don't know. That's part of the issue I'm really worried about the money.
Would it help clarify the situation if we knew what would happen in the subsequent year? What are we aiming to do after the crops come off?
Well, clearly, anything more that we know than we don't know now is about to clarify the situation. Whether it's going to help enough to be able to make a rational decision is not so clear to me.
So there's a downside of not doing anything for a year?
There are all sorts of things, I think. So first of all, there are the downsides to do with not being able to get the wild plough margins in now, not being able to encourage the wildlife in different ways. We also don't know what the consequences are with respect to natural inland.
Yeah, can I ask a question about that? What would natural inland think if we didn't take their advice?
I don't know. You're asking the question, I can't possibly know the answer to it.
I think it's a very pertinent question because, you know, they have given us their advice is to use the herbicide.
That is true, but Claire Harris, the advisor, came up with the scheme whereby we did the deep ploughing in order to get around the fact that the association didn't want to use the herbicide. I'm getting a bit fed up with being sort of piggy in the middle, to be honest. Yes, Ian.
If we don't plough this year, the problem is still there.
The problem is still there. We have longer to sort it out.
It's earlier on.
We have longer to sort it out.
Yes,
and we may, but we don't know whether we actually will lose some of the subsidy.
Raising
the
change, that might be different in a year. That's advice for everything scientific, isn't it?
So, can we go back to the options, if I can remember them now? So, option one was just grazing. Option two was, well, let's I think these numbers are different, but let's do it. So, option two is do the herbicide. And option three is get the deep ploughing done, pay for it, without getting much in the way of crop off it, but not use the herbicide. So let's do
three.
The one.
Three.
Okay, so first of all, who's in favour of just having the White Park cattle graze the land?
For this year.
It's
just the beginning. The delay your decision. Yeah.
Two, three. Okay.
Four.
Who's in favour of agreeing to the farmer that we should use the herbicide in a general way? Who's in favour of, what is that, sort of kind of middle option, isn't it? We pay for the ploughing, we somehow or other bear the costs, whatever they might be, but we don't use the herbicide. And that means that we'd be able to put the flowers in and so on this year. That's one of you.
Some people haven't voted.
I've been watching your watch. You're allowed to abstain.
Yeah, you're allowed to abstain.
So the abstention to win,
though. No, I think it was quite that way. Well, I don't know. Who abstained? Put your hand up if you abstained. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I said, I haven't put my hand up.
You have a casting vote.
So, I mean, what that comes down to, I think, is...
You don't need to meet up and decide the abstainers.
Okay, I mean, that at least is a bit helpful. It gives me a bit of a steer on what people feel. I mean, I think there's just going to be a big row about this. Okay, thank you very much. And thank you, Chris.